I got into bone health because it's a big part of nutrition, and I was diagnosed with osteopenia a couple of years ago. I was really surprised when I got the diagnosis. I have been active all my life. I have a high calcium diet, so it was really surprising and a little disappointing.
Every year, millions of Americans, a disproportionate number of them women, have their lives changed by bone health issues and injuries. Today on Living Healthy Together, we'll take a closer look at how rising public health concerns around osteoporosis and low bone mass are getting public attention in local communities. You'll hear from experts in orthopedics, physical therapy, nutrition, primary care, and gynecology, and learn what you can do at home and in your healthcare provider's office to protect and improve your bone health. I'm your host, Philip Rao. We're joined now by Deborah Brown, a family nurse practitioner from Central Vermont Medical Center, who's a member of the hospital's sports and orthopedics team. We kick off our discussion today and talk about why they're so passionate about raising awareness and understanding of this health topic. Welcome, and thanks for being with us today. Deborah, what got you interested in orthopedics? Did you come to it later in your career, or is this scope of practice something that's always been a focus for you?
I have been a board-certified nurse practitioner since 2011. My first role was in orthopedics, and then I took a little break and worked in rheumatology for about 5 years, and I've returned to this practice in orthopedics for about the last year.
What got you interested in orthopedics?
Orthopedics has become part of my life since I was 17. I played sports in school and then suffered an injury to my anterior cruciate ligament. So I had surgery on that and shifted my career path. So I started out my career as an athletic trainer and did that for about 10 years. So musculoskeletal and orthopedic things have always sort of been strong in my life. And then I became an RN and worked primarily in orthopedic units and then went back to nurse practitioner school. And the draw was always to orthopedics at that stage in life.
How have things grown and changed and developed over the course of your career? A lot of different health and wellness things, understanding of food and nutrition, understanding of how exercise works, change and grow over time. Is it the same for bone health and for orthopedic science in general?
I think the field of orthopedics in general is one of those exciting and ever-changing specialties as far as surgical techniques. You know, the surgeons that I work with here certainly do some similar procedures that they have done for 20 and 30 years, but also there's been some amazing changes that shorten recovery and improve outcomes. So that's exciting. So, you know, things like joint replacements and ACL surgeries certainly look very, very differently now, especially at something like an ACL reconstruction than it did when I had it done in 1987.
How does bone health fit into this landscape and what you guys are seeing? Is it the same thing? Bone health concerns or impacts affecting a broader demographic of people?
I think one of the things in general is that we need to be aware of our young people and their bone health modeling and remodeling at such a key time of life for our bone mass, right? So that's the time frame where we're really able to achieve the most bone mineral density and bone health. So I think looking at the other end where we're treating fractures related to bone mineral density, so it's fragility fractures and those outcomes, I think the general trend is that we're probably seeing more, and the expectation is we're going to continue to see more as time goes on.
You've got multiple personal connections to bone health and the impacts that people feel because of bone health challenges. Tell us a little bit about how bone health has impacted you and your family.
Aside from seeing my friends and their parents, I have two older sisters, and we're all reasonably active and healthy. And I had a sister that had some back pain and wasn't going away. So she did seek an x-ray, and she did have a compression fracture, and she just turned 60. So it's a little bit sobering and humbling to have a bone fragility fracture, because basically a compression fracture is always related to bone health. And my other sister had some workup for some vitamin D deficiency and parathyroid hormones. So basically that prompted both of them prior to the age of 65 to undergo bone density studies, which is a DEXA scan or DXA scan. And both have osteoporosis. So that prompted me to say at 57, I'm going to talk to my primary care provider and request that maybe I should be screened for my bone health as well, given my family history. Because fortunately, unfortunately, it just is what it is. 60 to 80% of our bone mineral density is likely related to genetics. So there's a component of our bone health that is sort of pre-programmed, and we have to sort of work within what we're dealt.
That's really interesting and also really scary, right? There's so many things in life that you can't control. And I like to fool myself into thinking, well, at least my health is something, at least to a certain extent, I can control. But this is something that you absolutely cannot.
Well, a portion of it, you cannot. When I have patients that feel like it's a failure on their part that they have osteoporosis or they've suffered a fragility fracture and they've been healthy, active, never a cigarette smoker, not an excessive drinker, like nothing really to like lifestyle choices. They've sort of checked all the boxes. And my response is always, well, imagine how much worse it would be if you had made different choices. So I think those things that we do control absolutely do help our general health and well-being, especially our bone health. And if we need assistance, whether it's through medications or treatment or workup, then sort of knowing that that's also available.
It's comforting to know that there are aspects of this that you do control, whether it's activity or diet, maybe other things that you want to mention. How big an impact can people make by doing the right things and making the right choices?
I think it's essential, like you said, to have some semblance of feeling like we have some control and management over our overall health. And I think those choices, and specifically the things that we know affect bone health negatively, so things that work against our bone health are smoking. It is being sedentary. I'm sure we've all heard sitting is the new smoking. So our sedentary lifestyle, our bones need that feedback loop of some stress to keep those cells producing more bone cells. So we know that if people have devastating injuries and have to be, you know, in bed for 3 months, we know there's this thing called disuse osteopenia. So our bone density falls off because of disuse. So I think sedentary lifestyle, smoking, there are some conditions, again, that we don't have much control over, but things like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease and celiac, these malabsorption syndromes can often affect our bone health, as well as oral steroid use. Sometimes people have medical conditions, whether they're respiratory conditions or inflammatory conditions, where they have to take oral steroids or prednisone for a period of time. And we know that also it affects our bone health and things like rheumatoid arthritis. I think our teenagers and our young people, nobody wants to think as a 15-year-old about their future osteoporosis. But really, those are such critical times for our bone mineral density. And I, again, speaking from personal experience, the person I'm worried about most is my daughter, who's, you know, 5'2". I'm 5'8". She's a short stature. She has celiac disease. She's low body weight. And she also has, in her early teens, a history of an eating disorder. So all of these things, you know, she's on my radar for her future as far as really being vigilant about saying like, hey, I've had all these things. I should really think about my bone health as I enter my 40s.
This brings this topic closer to home for me because my wife is 5'1", 5'2". She has celiac disease. She has a thyroid condition that required the removal of her thyroid. So this is becoming more and more a thing that I feel like I need to be thinking about and aware of, which is troubling and cool at the same time. I don't know how to explain the sensation. I want to go back and talk for a minute about your personal experience. What have you seen in your loved ones, the impacts of these injuries? How do bone health challenges impact a person's life? I think many people are going to think it's really straightforward, right? Oh, you fracture your leg, you can't walk. But it's probably much more complex than that.
It is. And I don't want to be the doom and gloom kind of person. It's always troubling to see your loved ones in pain, right? So my sister who had that compression fracture, it hurts. And it hurts, for sometimes a prolonged period of time. And it also affects her activity level, doing her usual walking routine and being a pretty active person. And that can be emotionally difficult as well as physically painful experience. And beyond that, my grandmother did fracture a hip and was alone and didn't have someone come check in on her for a couple of days. So I wasn't unable to get to a phone. So it's that kind of situation where somebody falls and injures and fractures a hip and is basically on the floor alone for a couple of days. It's troubling. It can be devastating in a way. Mortality, meaning the death rate after a hip fracture, anywhere from 8.5% to 36% of people who suffer a hip fracture may die within that first year after that injury.
Really alarming. I doubt anyone listening right now knows that off the top of their heads.
And interestingly, that mortality rate or that death rate is a slightly higher for men who suffer hip fracture. So even though this issue has a higher prevalence in women, especially Hispanic, Caucasian women, the mortality is slightly higher in men who suffer a hip fracture. And then beyond that, people who have hip fracture, 20% of them will likely need some sort of long-term care. And 60% will not really be able to return to their prior level of independence. I think that for me is always the most troubling thing to see, is that as somebody has this injury, we treat the injury typically with a surgery and through no fault of their own, unable to resume their independent life that they once led. It's troubling and sad.
You were part of a team from CVMC that did an event recently, a public event on bone health that was incredibly well received and well attended in the community. Why is the community there so in tune with this issue and wants more information?
That's a really good question. I'm not a born and bred Vermonter, but I've been here for 26 years and I have patients that I've seen and taken care of. Like, we're fiercely independent. And I think people are much more proactive about their health here. The other factor is, I think people in general, whether it's personal or a family member or a loved one or a neighbor, it's pervasive in our community. It touches many, many people. So it's an important health topic. And I think it's important personally to a lot of people because they want to know more. I think sometimes we're sort of starving for information and access to health topics. So people are more proactive about seeking that out.
Sounds like it was a great evening. Do you have a favorite moment?
I don't know if there's a single moment. I was impressed with the attendance. There were enough seats in the house to accommodate everyone that wanted to attend. I think the most exciting part is there was a discussion after that we should probably make this an annual event to make that available to as many people as we can.
What do people need to know? If you've never thought about your bone health, you've never had a conversation with your PCP or with your orthopedic provider about this, what's the starting point for someone who says, I'm listening to this and now I want to do something?
I think the understanding that it's an issue, we just need to keep pecking away. And sometimes things are too overwhelming to take on all the arms of all the things at the same time. So the best thing for our bones is to move and do some weight-bearing activity, whether it's walking, hiking. There's been some exciting research about strengthening and weight training as a really important way to help with our bone density, as well as help with falls prevention, right? So that's the other big take-home message, is doing everything we can to keep ourselves from falling, which means strength and balance and mobility, if possible, and then avoiding those things that we know negatively affect our bone health. Cigarette smoking, if you can, long-term use of oral steroids, inactivity, and making those baby steps as far as identifying, do I get enough calcium? Do I get enough vitamin D? Do I get some veggies? So, am I drinking lots and lots of soda or things that affect our overall well-being. There is also, I want to mention too, just for people, you know, really hungry for information, it used to be the National Osteoporosis Foundation, but they've renamed it the Bone Health and Osteoporosis Foundation. They have a brilliant website that's really well thought out for both patients and providers. That has got a wealth of information on it about anything from dietary things to exercise to screening, all of that in one very tidy site. It's bonehealthandosteoporosis.org, and they abbreviate it BHOF.
All right. We'll link this site in the episode description. So if you're listening to the podcast version, you can get it there. It's time for a quick break. When we come back on Living Healthy Together, we'll sit down with a physical therapist, orthopedic specialist, and member of the CVMC rehabilitation team who'll talk about exercise, bone health, and why we all need to get out there and safely, always safely, lift really heavy things. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. This week, we're digging into bone health and conditions like osteoporosis, what people need to know about keeping their bones healthy, and how they can talk to their healthcare team about questions or concerns about their own health and risk factors. We're joined now by Jackie Jankitis, a physical therapist and orthopedic certified specialist at CVMC. Jackie, where do physical therapists fit into the spectrum of prevention, treatment, and support for folks who are experiencing bone health challenges?
Physical therapists are pretty broad when it comes to taking care of people who are working on their bone health. So people working on their bone health are concerned with everything from just being active and getting through their daily activity to doing things that are harder that might seem more challenging, or on the other spectrum, things that might feel unsafe and lead to things such as falls and fractures in their bones. So physical therapists can help with all of the spectrum of those issues, from someone who maybe wants to do something really hard, such as landscaping or being strong enough to lift up their grandchildren, to someone who may have experienced an injury to their bones and they need to rehabilitate something like a broken bone just to get back to their daily activity.
Let's talk about exercise and its importance to an impact on bone health. What does it mean to have healthy bones? Is that purely the appropriate amount of mineral density, or are there other aspects of bone health that folks need to know about?
Physical therapy and physical health are really the exciting part, I think, of taking care of your bone health. So for some people, they're going to be like, oh, I got to go see the doctors to talk about my bone health. That doesn't sound very exciting. I think we have the fun part. So exercise and movement can make your bones healthier. Exercise and movement can prevent you from having bone health issues. And that's really important that we talk about this not just being something for people who have a bone health or bone mineral density issue. It's also the ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure. So exercise can help you prevent bone health issues, but if you do have bone health issues, it can also help you reverse some of those effects. And it's in the more fun ways that people like to do. People love feeling strong. They love feeling safe and capable. And so that's the fun part with exercise as your medicine, is that you can reverse these things without having to always just rely on one form of treatment. So exercise can be a really big portion, along with diet and working with your physician on medications.
How can people maintain healthy bones and prevent bone health challenges? Are there specific exercises they can do, things that they should focus on, and other things that don't work?
Thinking about the prevention side of things, I would say, if I can actually step back for a second and give a little bit more foundational information, which spans both prevention and treatment. When it comes to bone health, the important thing to realize is that our bones react to any stimuli we give them. And if we don't give them stimuli, they unfortunately become less strong. So the major thing for people to realize is that throughout your life, and I mean everything from being a young person to a middle-aged person to an aging person, we need to continue to live active, healthy lifestyles that include, honestly, doing things that are hard. So for bone mineral density and bone health, that means that people need to lift heavy things. And they need to lift heavy things on a consistent basis, meaning weekly. And it needs to be something that's really challenging. And that's how you prevent a bone mineral density issue, otherwise known as osteopenia or osteoporosis. And that's how you can reverse some of the effects from that as well.
People think of osteoporosis or bone health in general as more of a female concern, but you're saying that everybody needs to do this. And everybody needs to lead an active and challenging life. How does that work across genders and across age groups? A 70-year-old guy can't do the same things that I can do as a 42-year-old.
We would love to just hang our hat on prevention. So we would love people that are in their 40s to be hearing this information and hear, I need to lift heavy things and I need to do it on a weekly basis. And I should do that for the rest of my life. Because that's where the prevention really is. But honestly, generally speaking, around the mid-40 area, you're going to start to plan on a decline in your body mass qualities due to hormone changes. And for a male sex, that's going to be testosterone changes. For a female sex, that's going to be estrogen changes. Those happen at very different rates. But from the 40s to, say, the 70s, that's going to still be a decline. And that's going to be one of the contributing factors to your bone mass mineral density. If you start lifting in your 40s and you still do it in your 50s and your 60s and your 70s, and we all know those wonderful farmers that are out there well into their 80s and 90s that can lift heavier things than I can, and they do it every week. Yes, that's how you stay strong and bone dense.
Let's talk about the treatment side of things. There's got to be a broad spectrum of severities in terms of the bone health related concerns that someone might have. Someone's just at the beginning, or someone's got really serious concerns. Maybe they've had a fracture or another injury. What's the scope of different treatments that are available?
When we talk about bone health and trying to reverse those issues, we're talking about lifting heavy things. That's really what it comes down to. You need to lift something that is on the range of the heaviest thing you can possibly lift. 50 to 85% of that heaviest thing. You need to lift that much weight at least 2 to 3 times a week. And you need to do that every week. Generally speaking, you're going to be doing that for 2 to 3 sets of 5 to 10 repetitions. So that's a lot of different ranges that I just gave you. And that sounds like, oh gosh, how could you figure out what you really need to do? Well, we're not cookies. We're not cookie cutter people. We need to have the variability so that we can find that thing that fits us. Because we're trying to get people to realize that there might feel like something doesn't feel safe. You're going to work with, hopefully, a physical medicine professional who's going to help you, guide you in a way that fits those parameters, but in a way that's safe and productive for you yourself.
Are there different lifting motions? When you say lift heavy weights, that makes sense to people, but I'm doing bench press, and so that takes care of the bones in my arms and shoulders and chest, but then I have to do squats because that takes care of the bones in my legs and my torso. Do people have to mix and match different movements to hit everything, or is just doing one thing hitting everything just by virtue of you doing it?
That's a really great question. And there's, again, variability in that because it always depends on the person. So you actually spelled that out beautifully. If I want to make sure that my arms and my wrists are really bone dense so that if I fall and land with my arm out in front of me, I'm not worried as much about a fracture, then yeah, you make a good point that bench press is an option. If you look at the research, the big ones are picking things up from the floor, picking something up heavy while you stand up from, say, a chair height, and picking up something heavy overhead. Those three motions, they're not just going to be the things that help you add density to your lower body, your spine, and your upper body, your arms, but they're also going to be things that are functional. We need to pick groceries up off the floor. We need to get out of a chair, and we need to put things up overhead. those are going to be different weights that you do with those different motions. But again, in each of those motions, we're looking for you to work as hard as you can, or 50 to 85% of the hardest that you can do one time of that motion.
So intensity definitely matters. What about balance?
I've never met anyone who doesn't trip, and I trip all the time. Falls are just part of life. And so if you have bone density, you're going to prevent that fracture if and when you fall. At the same time, that balance component that you practice also helps you to have reaction ability so that you may trip, but do you actually fall?
What about things that don't work? There's a ton of exercise programs, alternative methods that are out there, water aerobics, low impact stuff. Are there things that people are doing that they might think do preserve or help their bone health, but actually isn't effective?
Yeah. And I hope if people are thinking about their bone density and their bone health, that they're thinking this through in a way of like, okay, well, if resistance is the thing that's gonna get me stronger bones, what are the things that aren't quite as challenging for that? And we do know that activities in water, or activities that are considered endurance, meaning they're lighter amplitude or challenge, but they happen for a really long time, those just don't cause the stimuli in your body to make your bones more dense.
Foundational information about bones that people may need to hear. In you're reading around a little bit before chatting with you, I had to be reminded by Google that bones are alive, right? Bones repair and strengthen and react the same way that the rest of our body does. And so if I'm not internalizing that, I wonder how many other folks aren't as well. Is there anything that you hear from patients routinely that they're surprised at learning something about their bones that just everybody should know?
Right. I think you said that really nicely. Yeah, your bones are alive. And we constantly do turn over and repair our bones. So we constantly are having pieces of our bones pulled out of our body, and then our body is designed to fill those holes back in with new, stronger bone. But if we're not giving it the stimuli, then it doesn't have a reason for that new bone to go back to be better than it was before. If you're not doing something that is training your body, and you know that you have risk factors, maybe your doctor has identified that you have osteopenia, osteoporosis, maybe you have a family history of these bone health issues, we want you to start thinking before it becomes actually a problem.
It's time for a quick break. When Living Healthy Together comes back, we'll sit down with a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and certified diabetes care and education specialist at Central Vermont Medical Center, whose own osteopenia diagnosis makes the topic of nutrition and bone health very personal. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're digging into bone health, risk factors, bone injuries, and why the right mix of diet, exercise, and awareness is critical for everyone's bone health. We're joined now by Nancy Wagner, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and certified diabetes care and education specialist who works primarily with care teams and patients at Central Vermont Medical Center. Nancy, thanks for joining us today. You've got a really strong personal connection to bone health as a health and wellness issue. Tell us how it came home to roost for you.
I got into bone health because it's a big part of nutrition, and I was diagnosed with osteopenia a couple of years ago, so it's near and dear to my heart too. Never thought I would have a problem because I'm active and a little bit overweight, which is supposed to be helpful for your bones. But yeah, found myself in that situation. And I love working with the providers that we have and the patients.
Talk about the experience of getting the osteopenia diagnosis. It's emotional, it's mental, it's physical. What was it like for you receiving that news, and what did you do?
I was really surprised when I got the diagnosis of osteopenia. I have been active all my life. I have a high calcium diet, so it was really surprising and a little disappointing. I did not do hormone replacement because I have some breast cancer risk in my family. So, you know, kind of wondered, okay, if I had done that, would that have helped? So a little bit of disappointment that I maybe didn't explore as much as I should have. But yeah, it was a little bit of a shock. But I did some more exploring myself and have added some more weights and exercise and really making sure that I'm getting enough calcium.
What do people need to know so they don't have the experience that you had? This surprise and kind of coming out of left field with a diagnosis like this that's really impactful and can really affect how you live your life.
Well, over the past 50 years, our diets have gotten so much worse. With bone health, we think of calcium and vitamin D. But it goes much deeper than that. When we eat a lot of quote-unquote junk processed foods, we have a lot of inflammation in our body, and that is going to wreak havoc on our body, on our bones. So we're actually leaching the calcium out of the bones by having lots of inflammation. So whole foods, plant-based diet is the best way to go.
That's terrifying. This issue is reminding me how little I know about my own body. Jackie had to remind me, Phil, your bones are alive. Broadly, you understand a healthy diet's important and it has a bunch of impacts. Mm-hmm. Didn't know that you could leach the calcium from your bones with an unhealthy diet. Are there foods that do this disproportionately more than others?
So it's not the food actually that's doing it. It's the inflammation in our body. And we have more inflammation with an unhealthy lifestyle. So if you're not sleeping enough, if you're not getting enough exercise, if you are eating processed foods, then it's all happening.
Is there a way for people to keep an eye on how much inflammation they may be experiencing? Is it a way that your body feels or at-home tests that you can use? How do people keep track of this?
As far as I know, there's no tests. But if you're starting to get some swelling in your joints or fluid retention at the end of the day in your ankles, if your socks are leaving a little bit of a ring around when you take your socks off, that's all inflammation. A lot of times we might feel achy. That can be inflammation. And you just want to make sure that you're staying hydrated, you're well rested, you're active, and you're eating mostly real foods for the most part. Not that we can't have quote unquote junk food, but just not the basis of our diet. I work with the pediatric group and we're seeing terrible eating habits in little kids. I think up until what, age 20, 25 is where we're laying down our bones, we're building them up. And if the kids aren't getting the foundation, then they're going into adulthood with weak bones already.
You're preaching to the choir here and getting me up on a soapbox. I have a 2-year-old and the thing that upsets me the most is every morning I hear about how he gets a donut when he gets into daycare, the first thing. We do such a good job at home, and there are these things that you can't control where it's just like,
yep,
why are you injecting that into my child's diet? Why are you doing that? What is your message to folks, and what information about nutrition vis-a-vis bone health do people really need, whether it's to maintain their bone health or to recover bone health if they're compromised?
Probably the biggest thing is eating a real food diet. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of diets out there. They all work to some degree, but for the most part, following a special diet is not going to work. There's no perfect diet. I think we're all overwhelmed because every day almost something comes out. No, you shouldn't be drinking coffee. Yes, you should be drinking coffee. And it's very confusing. But if we are eating real food, not in packages, but real food. It doesn't all have to be organic, but it should be real. And the least amount of processed food that we can have. And then cooking it yourself. We've gotten into the habit of eating out, ordering out packaged frozen foods. And if we can just get back to cooking and preparing things at home, you're going to save money, you're going to save time, and you're going to eat healthier. And that's the gist of it.
Is there any issue with or difference between a fresh vegetable and a canned or a frozen vegetable?
Well, the canned vegetables tend to have sodium in them and the canned fruits tend to be sweetened. So staying away from those if you can. You can get low sodium vegetables. I learned one time that they will take the inferior fruits and vegetables and put them in cans because they can cover up a lack of taste with salt or a lack of taste with sugar. So fresh is always best if we can get it. And it's a little bit harder in the winter time. And there's really nothing wrong with frozen. A lot of times they're processed and they're flash frozen that day. So they might actually be a little bit healthier for us, but no sugar added to the frozen fruits, no sauces or sodium added to the fresh vegetable or the frozen vegetables.
For folks that have osteopenia, you've mentioned kind of the corrective action that you've taken or the changes that you've made. How do you evaluate how effective that is?
So in some ways, that's the hard part, because I think the only way they track it is with the DEXA scan. And that's what, every year, every couple of years, depending on your situation. So it's not immediate feedback. And really all you can do is make sure you're getting adequate calcium and vitamin D, getting outside in the sun when you can, getting that exercise, and like the physical therapists talk about, getting that bone building, strength building physical activity so that you are working your muscles and your bones and at least keeping what you have, if not building better bones. One of my big messages is don't strive for that perfect diet. There's a lot of nutrients out there that we have to try to incorporate in our diet, and just do the best you can. And lots of fruits and vegetables. You need some protein throughout the day. It doesn't have to be totally vegetarian. Just making sure that you're getting some fish and some healthy fats. And then just don't worry about it. Just do the best you can.
Living Healthy Together is taking a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with an OBGYN and menopause specialist about how the hormone changes women experience later in life can have big impacts on bone health, and a primary care provider who will share her insights on how you can make bone health a part of your routine conversations with members of your own care team. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together and our deep dive into bone health. We're joined now by Dr. Colleen Horan, an obstetrician and gynecologist at Central Vermont Medical Center, who specializes in menopause-related care and leads the hospital's team of midwives and OBGYNs, and Emily Byrne, a family nurse practitioner, director of advanced practice professionals at CVMC, and a specialist in public health. Thank you both for joining us and talking bone health today. Dr. Horan, some folks may be surprised that you're here as an OBGYN, but menopause and bone health, actually really big deal and really closely linked. Talk about what menopause is, when it starts, and when women need to start being on the lookout for signs and symptoms, because there's such a thing as early menopause too.
Menopause is when the body naturally stops making estrogen. The ovaries stop responding with creating follicles and eggs, which is part of the process where they make estrogen. The clinical definition of menopause is once someone has gone a full year without a menstrual period, and that happens on average in the United States at about age 51. That's menopause. And there is the perimenopause or the menopause transition, which is the time period leading up to the last menstrual period, which is where the feedback loops and the hormones and the production of estrogen starts to fluctuate in ways that are not as predictable as they are during a usual menstrual cycle, but you get highs and lows and a lot more variability or hormonal fluctuation before the ovaries completely cease making estrogen.
What about early menopause?
Early menopause would be when menopause occurs prior to age 45, and premature menopause would be when it occurs prior to age 40. And early or premature menopause can be caused by some kind of a medical condition or a surgery, or you can have something that's called primary ovarian insufficiency, which is where the ovaries just stop making estrogen earlier than is expected.
You're an expert in public health as well. Position us a little bit in terms of what the hospital is seeing and what you're seeing.
So I'm a member of Generation X, which is the generation that is currently going through or has recently gone through the menopause transition, depending upon where in Generation X you fit. The significance of the menopause transition and postmenopausal care is that you see an increased risk of cardiovascular disease in women after menopause. And then what we're here to talk about today is, of course, bone health. And there's a significant loss of bone density that occurs across the menopause transition. And osteoporosis and its related risks of fractures and such are a significant public health problem in women as they age. Up to 1 in 2 or 50% of women will sustain an osteoporotic fracture at some point in their lifetime. And osteoporotic fractures are associated with an increased risk of mortality and maybe even more importantly, morbidity and loss of independence for women. And that has a significant cost to society.
And the numbers are really arresting. Women can lose up to 10% of their bone density within 5 years of starting menopause. That's a fairly shocking number to me, even not really understanding exactly what that means. Is there a way to put that in a box or frame it for folks?
Basically, the data comes from a longitudinal study that's called the SWAN study, or the Study of Women's Health Across the Nation. And they looked at women on a regular basis and checked their bone density and checked certain cardiovascular markers and asked about certain menstrual parameters. And what they actually found is that there was a loss of bone of about 2% per year that actually begins 1 to 3 years before menopause, so before you stop having menstrual periods. And that loss of about 2% a year can last for 5 to 10 years. And that's where you get the about 10% loss of bone density across the menopause transition. And the way that bone density is measured, it's measured in something that's called a T-score, which is comparing someone's bone density to the bone density of a healthy young adult at peak bone mass. And it turns out that 10% drops you at about 1 T-score. So it drops you significantly, a significant loss in bone density across that menopause transition. And then after that, we continue to lose bone density, but at a slower rate. So it starts to drop off that loss is at about 0.5% a year as opposed to 2% a year. And what you end up, the net effect is that by the time a woman is 80, she's lost 30% of her peak bone mass. And so you're seeing more and more risk of fragility fractures and the loss of independence that comes with it.
Emily, you're a family medicine practitioner, so you're a PCP. What brought you into becoming interested in bone health and helping to put on this incredibly well-received event that CVMC did earlier this year that really showed just how much public interest there is in this topic?
I work with a lot of women in my practice and have done so for over 20 years. And osteoporosis and screening for osteoporosis is not new. One of my initiatives is creating community education events, and a topic that comes up frequently in practice, both because we screen for this condition and also treat it, is osteoporosis. As a primary care provider, I am frequently talking to people about their health and strategies to remain well and independent. Bone health is critical to both of those. And so having a public forum where we can provide our community with information and the resources about bone health and treatment of osteoporosis was something I was very interested in.
This topic, there are so many layers to it. There are things that you can control, things that are genetically predetermined and that you cannot control. One of the things we can all control is being aware and talking about it with our healthcare team. Are your patients more likely to talk about this with you now than they were 20 years ago? And if they are, why do you think that is?
I think they are more interested in talking about it now for a couple of reasons. Most recently, menopause specifically has been in the news, and discussing the impact that menopause has on women's health is widely talked about. I think there was a perception at one point that osteoporosis was inevitable, and there was more of a passive stand related to our bone health. And now we're understanding, and patients are asking for, what are proactive strategies that they can incorporate to not only maintain their current bone health, but also build and improve their bone health. And so we have a much more robust discussion that engages and empowers people to take charge of their bone health.
One of the things that I don't think we've talked about on this episode is that osteoporosis is, quote unquote, a silent disease. And that means that there are no symptoms that tell you you're experiencing this loss of bone density, of bone health, until you get an injury. How do PCPs approach these types of health concerns where there's no way for the person who's experiencing them to know that's what's going on?
You're absolutely correct that osteoporosis is a silent disease and there are no symptoms until somebody has a fracture. Primary care has the broad view of seeing patients both holistically and over a period of time, often many, many years. In my case, almost 2 decades with my current patients. And so we can see various lifestyle factors, family factors, medication factors that all have a significant impact on their bone health and bring up strategies that patients can adopt early on to prevent bone loss, maybe adjust treatment such as medications to prevent bone loss, and offer appropriate screening based on these risk factors and not wait until someone sustains a fracture to then be reactive and treat the problem. I've been in this community now for 20 years. My patients have gotten older, but it's still crucial to have these conversations with our young patients because that's the prime time to really educate them about the importance of healthy nutrition, exercise, maximizing their calcium, vitamin D intake to build that peak bone mass, which occurs right around age 20.
Dr. Horan, one of the things I've heard from other experts is that lifestyle changes are the most important thing for folks to take heed of, making sure you're eating the right stuff, making sure you're active and lifting heavy things. When you get into the time in your life when menopause is occurring, can those things arrest that loss of bone density that you're talking about that happens naturally?
You are still going to lose bone density, but the lifestyle changes can definitely help to slow it. And it's not just the bone density, it's also your fitness and having good balance so that you don't fall. So it's a few different things that lifestyle factors can impact there. Part of why women lose bone density so quickly across the menopause transition is that loss of the natural production of estrogen in our bodies. And supplementing estrogen can prevent osteoporosis. Now, it turns out that supplementing estrogen and exercising works much better than just supplementing estrogen alone. So you need to have the lifestyle interventions as well. For a lot of women in their 40s, it's a time when people are maybe not doing great self-care. We're full on into careers and full on into childbearing, and perhaps our own parents are aging. What's happening in your 40s while you're taking care of everyone else is you're starting to lose your own health and protection. And the nice thing about lifestyle intervention, although it's hard, it can seem like it's hard to make the time for it, if we do it, it can protect our bones and also our cardiovascular health, which are the two things that are really going to catch up with us as we go from 40 to past 50.
Everyone can do something, whether it's increase the calcium in their diet, work with physical therapy, start doing squats, talk to their healthcare provider about menopause and impact of estrogen, looking at their home environment, what are the fall risks within their home, and having these conversations. Everyone needs to advocate for their health and advocate for their bones.
Dr. Colleen Horan, Emily Byrne, thank you both for joining us today. Thank you to all of our guests across the continuum of bone health care. That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.